This is Daniels for MR Radio, and I'm with GW as always, and we have the privilege of speaking today with Susan Lindauer, the former CIA asset who is known as a negotiator of Lockerbie, a negotiator of Iraq weapons inspection, and having foreknowledge of the 9/11 events. Now, as someone who is very averse to conspiracy theories, it took someone of Lindauer's stature and honor to get me to listen more carefully to this, as I generally tend to look upon these things through a litmus test of whether I really need this theory. And when it comes to 9/11, it was clear that Arabs, or Muslims rather, were miffed with America for the fact that it had such close ties and was at least somewhat controlled by Israel and Jewish interests. However, the facts of 9/11 do show the depth and egregious extent of that influence, so it does help, to say the least. Now, we don't intend to go into too much depth what Susan is known for. There are many podcasts that can be looked up if people want to refer back to that, though we will go into some background. And I'd like to preface this discussion by saying that as European nationalists, as white nationalists, we share a great interest in Susan's perspective as a peace activist. I think that we have a wide consensus that these wars are not our idea, they're not in our interest, this is not how we would generally like to proceed. Having said that, I would like to ask Susan to sketch a little bit of her background, the context of her experience in life as a CIA asset.
Sure. There's some very important details, but I'll make them fast. First of all, I was the chief CIA asset covering the Iraqi embassy and the Libya house at the United Nations in New York. That is a very specific responsibility. It gave me a great deal of power, which surprises some people who first hear my story, because I was inside the embassies, inside both of those embassies, dealing with the ambassadors, dealing with the senior diplomats, and members of the Security Council. I knew the ambassador of Yemen, and I was very tied in with Malaysia, and all of the diplomats on involved in the sanctions issue. And so when I say I was the chief asset covering Iraq at the United Nations, there are bona fides that are associated with that. That does not mean that I endorsed the other thing is that my focus was on anti-terrorism. The reason that I did my work from 1995 until 2003, I had meetings every week with both the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, and about every three weeks, I would go up to New York from Washington, and I would meet with diplomats from Libya, from Iraq. So that was my context. It does not mean that I supported all of the Clinton administration policy. I opposed the Bush administration policy, but in terms of the war, my team gave advance warning about 9/11, and I don't. I hope everyone will understand that I really want to focus. I want to refer you to my other podcasts for that. I became notorious. I was outed by the Bush administration when I became the second non-Arab American ever indicted on the Patriot Act. I was arrested 30 days after requesting to testify on Capitol Hill in front of Congress, sworn under oath, about the real facts of Iraqi pre-war intelligence. I had contacted the United States Senate, John McCain, and Senator Trent Lott's chief of staff. This is recorded on wiretaps, which we have. So, you know, I can prove everything that I say. This is very some of what I know and what people, what I've reported to people, they say, oh my God, could this really have happened? Because it's such a horrifying outcome after such a lengthy period of dedicated service. But it really shows how significant my field of expertise is, and the desperate effort, or the violent, the brutal effort to try to control history. And whatever your political philosophy is, you've got to have the real facts of the choices that are being made so that you can assess leadership and you can assess that, like, for example, if you're a Republican, I would tell you stay away from the Bush family because they will deputize the bureaucracy to commit crimes against the people. And that is a very serious issue when you have bureaucrats who are anonymous, faceless people who are being given orders to break the law. But I don't want to go off on that too much right now, except to say that that's going to be a major issue in 2016.
It'll be a major issue in this interview with a bit of luck.
Yes.
So your view of the relationship of the CIA to government, politics, and people has changed dramatically from when you started.
Yes.
How do CIA employees feel privately about some of what they are asked to do?
There is heavy demoralization. They feel that they were forced to do things. They were pushed to do things when they have done what I tried to do and pushed back and tried to stop bad things. John Kiriakou is a former CIA man who was sent to prison for exposing the United States was involved in renditions and waterboarding and torture. He is in prison on a 30-month sentence. He is the only individual who was ever prosecuted for torture, and he was prosecuted because he opposed it. So you see, what you see is every time a CIA asset like myself, like Kiriakou, I've known other people. You know, just I get emails from people saying, I got prosecuted. I would urge you to interview Chip Tatum, who exposed Iran-Contra. You'd get a kick out of him. They diesel therapied him. That means they move him to a different prison every night so that he won't be in the same place. And overnight, he's in a truck driving to the next place, and he arrives at the new prison the next morning, and then they have to move him again. But it was because he exposed Iran-Contra and the CIA's drug running. And he was actually part of Iran-Contra for a long time himself, and he has it all on tape. He was wiretapping all of this stuff for his own protection. So he's nailed the biggest politicians in Washington, including President Clinton and President George Bush.
So unfolding some of your understanding of some of the ways of power, but what does it want? What is it thinking?
The problem is that individuals who are tasked to participate in activities that are against their own values, that they don't like. Most people, most of your audience, if you think back, you will remember that both Blair and Bush blamed the intelligence community for bad intelligence, shoddy intelligence work before the war. And instead of standing with the courage of conviction and taking responsibility for their own decisions, their own mistake in going to war, they turned on us and said, oh, she was incompetent. God, she really let us down. Well, let me tell you what I did very briefly. I had deeply opposed the war. I was an anti-war activist, and I had been inside the Iraqi embassy. We had a peace option on the table that hammered out all conceivable angles for American benefits. We had the weapons inspections, an FBI task force that was going to operate inside Iraq with authorization to do terrorism investigations. The Iraqis agreed to give preferential contracts in any reconstruction period to U.S. corporations in all of the following areas: telecommunications, healthcare, hospital equipment, pharmaceuticals. Oil was going to be a major component of the next phase of development, preferential contracts to rebuild the oil pipelines and the pumping stations in Iraq, and they guaranteed the United States could have access to oil development contracts. There was a lot of good. The peace dividend would have been very strong, and it would have been heavily weighted towards the United States.
But it wouldn't have served the interests, obviously, that were being served through conflict. So what were those interests?
What is the nature of the executives behind these decisions? Then are they sociopaths?
I would say
and
that's
totally
true.
Corrupt. And what do they think of the people they do not serve? Whether is there any true patriotism in them, or are they wholly given over to the ends of the modern state?
There's a great quote that patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels, and I am a patriot, so usually that quote offends me. But when I see the sociopaths in Congress, and I see that the Democrats and the Republicans have pretty much morphed into the same party. They're pretty much the same. They're trying to say they're different. But only around the edges. They really have no power anymore. They demagogue all these issues, but these are sociopaths. They will say any words that come out of their mouth are just a matter of convenience to get you to go away. They don't want the people to bother them. They are no longer beholden to you at all. When I deal with Congress, they're scornful of ordinary people. If you're not a big campaign contributor, it's reached the point where you shouldn't even bother them.
But how do you believe in politics? Do you have any sympathies to particular politics?
Do I have sympathies? I have sympathies with the American people.
Susan,
I have sympathies with the people of the world who are subject to these horrible men.
Can I just get
who
back
are doing
to
these stupid things?
To where we were heading a minute ago. While you were agreeing a program that would have been extremely beneficial for the American public
Hammering
and for American industry, obviously there was a missing component there that was more important than all the benefits that flowed from that. Can we assume, if we give that a name, would we call that a military-industrial component, or would we call it a financial component, or both? How would you characterize the component that was not favored sufficiently within that regime you were, you know, attempting to negotiate? And therefore launched the whole conflict?
Yes. The Halliburton military-industrial complex component.
Right.
Yes. This and the Blackwater component. These are the defense industrial complex is a junkie. It's a debt junkie. It is a welfare state of its own creation. Whenever I hear Republicans or Democrats talk about how they don't want to have a welfare state, I think of the military-industrial complex, and I realize it's foregone. It's a foregone conclusion. We have bankrupted ourselves for
these.
They're
the biggest welfare queens.
Yes, they are. They truly are, and they have no loyalty to us. This is so important. Right now, we're seeing that the ISIL fighters have the best technology, and it's being paid for by Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has been funding the United States war against ISIL, but it's also been funding ISIL on the side.
Are you sure
and
about
so,
that?
Yes.
Because,
yeah.
You know, Gunner, my experience is that what's broadly known as international finance is not interested as such in, you know, what you would regard as normal commercial profits. But what it is interested in is controlling debt. And it functions by you know, for example, if you are going to attack a certain country, or if a country is going to attack another country, selling the arms in itself and whatever profits you may make on selling arms is not important, only to the arms manufacturers who have their cut, but fundamentally the issue of political control redounds to control of debt, does it not? And is that not where this is really driven from? I'm only just suggesting this as a...
Both are true, I think, because the last thing America manufactures is weapons systems. It's really the only thing we're capable of shipping right now.
It's our manufacturing base.
It's our last remaining industry, and they have to have new conflicts at all times so that they can keep paying their shareholders and keep maintaining their industrial capacity. So they require new conflicts that can never cease. But at the same time, I absolutely agree with what GW is saying, that that it's all about accumulating debt and acquiring more debt. And managing it, and the more debt you enforce on someone, the more you can control their policies. You can dictate to them what they're going to be allowed to do. Exactly. And of course, everything then becomes sacrifices that are required to pay for these things. But yes, I agree with you. I agree with what you just said.
Susan, what do you think of immigration and forced integration?
I have very mixed feelings about immigration, because in America we're supposed to be the melding pot. That's part of our tradition, and yet we're collapsing to our knees under the weight of it. The people coming in don't have the education. We can't afford to pay for their education. I'll give you an example. I sat through a conference as a congressional staffer 10 years ago with Hispanic leaders who complained that their school children were expected to learn to read books. And they said, in our culture, we don't have books, so you are handicapping our children in the schools by insisting that they have to learn to read. Why can't you find a different way to teach us that does not require literacy? And I remember just sitting there thinking, holy God, what the, you don't want us to teach, how are these people going to participate in a healthy, vibrant economy that grows and builds if their own leaders resent that they have to be educated? If they're, they want to come here, they're happy to be the lowest rung and to accept the welfare. Just give us our welfare check. And that riles me. That roils me. That pisses me off.
In nationalist circles, there's a great deal of attention to the 1965 Immigration Naturalization Act and suggestions as to who's behind that as a turning point where immigration started to become unreasonable.
Well, there's also, for example, like we're having some very serious problems with the Arabs. And then the government says, well, we now have these immigrants, these Arab immigrants living here who want to cause harm to us. So you, the rest of the American people, are now required to sacrifice your privacy, our basic freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom to exist without government interference, government militarization. I mean, we're seeing a whole, like the Patriot Act is very offensive. They've criminalized free speech in the United States now. On the auspices that we're protecting ourselves from these immigrants, so why don't we just keep them out? Well, we can't, because we're all supposed to be a melding pot of a global economy.
So you see this as a phenomenon of international capital?
Yes. International capital and driving down. I see it as an effort to break the United States. I think the debt, what you said about debt a moment ago is very prescient.
See, it's the same in Australia and New Zealand. It's the same all over Western Europe. It's uniform. It's not simply the United States. There is the same general dispensation throughout.
Let me give you another example.
Yep.
Ebola. Why do we have to have open borders without quarantines from Western Africa?
Because the value of human movement to the people who hold real power, true power, is greater than any suffering that might be caused, death and suffering might be caused as a result of human movement. This is the issue. Now you have to say, well, what does human movement actually signify in historical terms that is so incredibly valuable, and to whom? And this is the great question, you know, which white nationalism, as it's known in America, and nationalism, as it's known in the rest of the European world, has been seeking to answer for the last 60 years. The first country to really indulge in this was my country, which began on 22nd of June 1948 by accident, I think, at that time, to slowly, steadily import completely racially alien people. And the result at the end of all of this is going to be that we will not be a white country. We will be minoritized. This is Great Britain you're talking about.
Yes.
We will be minoritized sometime in the mid-2040s on current figures.
Was there a general position on these issues by the CIA?
No. No, I think quite the opposite. I think that would be something that they would consider to be alarming. That the in the United States, I mean, this has contributed. Actually, it has. Okay, what you're saying has contributed to certain actions by the CIA in the United States, especially with regards to drug access and drug distribution. I remember having a 20 years ago having a very candid discussion with a senior CIA man who said, frankly, that they wanted cocaine and crack to reach the minority communities in South Central Los Angeles and
Chicago. I guess
Chicago,
heroin, too.
And heroin, too, because it was they considered it necessary to find a way to keep these people occupied and distracted and pretty much incapacitated so that they would not have the faculties to interfere with the policy making that was going to be enacted on any front. They don't want them participating. And I think that what's happening now is when I see that the push for legalization of drugs in Colorado, in Washington State, they're going to tell us our economy's fine. They're going to tell us that unemployment is low. But in fact, we all know that's not true. Obama tried to pass a new law saying that full employment was now 30 hours a week instead of 40 hours a week. Right. Well, that's really part-time job.
With no
but
benefits.
They're trying to recategorize that as full-time employment. But what you have now is a situation where the poorest people who are former middle class have to be intoxicated, have to be crippled. And drugs are a very good way of doing that, to stop them from acting out.
What do you think of Mike Rupert and his take on all of that? Because he thinks the CIA is a major source for drug running.
Yes, it is. He's right. Mike Rupert is absolutely correct. Mm. But that's why it is a political agenda. It is a political agenda. It has a purpose. Getting the drugs into these communities is a rational methodology for controlling their functionality so that they cannot interfere, they cannot organize dissent, and then the powers that be will just continue on unencumbered, unaccountable. You're not able to demonstrate and protest if you're doped up. Mm. I promise you.
Mm. A little different to this, but we've always had in this country some quite strict controls on gambling, on horse race betting and so on, and almost as though some kind of 19th century, you know, church attitude, religious attitude to the working class pleasures. But
yes,
some years ago now, during the sort of New Labour period, the idea suddenly arrived amongst politicians that we should be building super casinos, and there were a number of plans brought forward to do that. They were quietly shelved, we were told, but I believe actually they were built in the end, and they're by and large built on the edge of working class areas. And of course, if you turn on the television these days, we've got quite a lot of different stations in the network now, advertising funded, and you know, every damn ad break there's another gambling. So gambling as an addiction is also being pushed into the culture. And all of this has happened quite quickly, I would say, over a period of a decade or less.
Yes, and they try to say here in America, they try to say that gambling will finance the schools. So it's okay that we should allow it to happen because they'll tax they'll dedicate the tax revenues from the gambling casinos to pay for school construction.
That's a lie,
and
because they don't hypothecate taxes in the States, do they?
No, they don't. But that's how they sell it.
Yeah,
that's how they are selling it, and they're pushing. And of course it's a redistribution of wealth, but it creates the illusion that you might be able to save yourself. If you're poor, if you're working class, you could go to this casino and you might be able to pull some money out.
Yeah,
it's very addictive. Had.
It's a delusion. But that's where we're at right now. I really see the United States. I mean, I'd like to say this on it. I hope you will put this in. I really see the United States collapsing and breaking apart in the very near future. I think maybe 5 years from now, I think that we're going to begin the throes of disintegration. I think that we'll get through 2016, but by 2020. We're going to be in a different game where we're going to be, instead of looking for a president to unite the country, we're going to be looking at how to break the country apart. And I think that Washington, of course, will fight desperately to stop any secession. But it will be a losing fight, and it will result in a civil war in the United States.
That comes to something that I want to ask you about, because it bears upon your expertise as a negotiator. I thought we might explore some possibilities through the healthy ambiguity inherent in the concept of negotiation, as it provides two routes, one being the negotiation of a deal, a fair exchange, and the other being negotiating your way around a conflict. And if
the problem for the United States is this: we used to be able to dictate the terms, and we would set the terms favorable to ourselves, and pretty much you would get out of your problem when you gave us whatever we wanted. The United States is no longer capable of exerting that force. We have lost something very, very, very precious. We've lost political capital, we've lost confidence, trust, the moral force of our position is gone.
Mm. So what do we do as communities?
So much.
That's a really good point.
In dealing with other countries, in dealing with China, in dealing with the London banks, HSBC, or any of our debt creditors, you see, because the United States has a very serious problem. We're bankrupt, and we don't want, and our government, the elite who could pay the taxes, don't want to, and the people who are poor can't. And it's reached the point where the IRS is grabbing everybody's money. Even if you're desperately, desperately poor, they come after us, but the rich people are exempt. So this is all, there is going to be a class struggle here, which is going to be aggravated by the fact that a lot of the immigrants are on welfare. We have a huge Hispanic population, as you know. They always come in and say they're going to work. And then when babies are born in Los Angeles County, within 90 days, 60% of newborn babies are on welfare from the Hispanic population. Okay, so we have all these Hispanics, for example, who are insisting they're going to hold jobs, they're going to work hard, they're not going to be welfare takers. No, they're going to hold three or four jobs. But when their babies are born, they're all registered for welfare. And when they need housing assistance, they need food stamps, all of this stuff, it has to be given to them. So what are we going to do? We have no money.
How are you making out with those trillions that you...
Yes. Here is an issue. this this is a very serious issue. I have been involved, and I'm happy to talk about this, in the recovery of the... Okay, the day before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld announced that $2.3 trillion had been stolen from the CIA Pentagon black budgets. That's a matter of record. A lot of the conspiracy theorists... And some of them who are not conspiracy theorists make a very good argument that, you know, it's awfully ironic that Donald Rumsfeld held that press conference announcing the money was stolen at the Pentagon in exactly the part of the Pentagon that got bombed on 9/11, so that a lot of those records were destroyed. I'm not sure, actually, since I know what happened, that that actually matters. I know who took the money. He is a federal inmate. He's been in prison since 1999, and he is a Chinese agent, okay? He took the money. He sold a percentage of theft. 100 of China's elite purchased into his theft $1 billion per point. Okay, at per point of theft and profits. You know, this wouldn't have been an issue if it had been dealt with 10 years ago when Donald Rumsfeld did try to deal with it. And it wouldn't have been an issue 5 years ago. But unfortunately, the more impoverished the United States becomes, the more beholden we are to the Chinese. You asked about our executive branch. I took the answer to Harry Reid. And I have documentation of taking this to Harry Reid, and Nancy Pelosi and Senator and a few other senators who I will spare them naming. And all of a sudden, I'm running into obstacles from Harry Reid's office, where Harry Reid's office is saying, "Don't go after this money. Stop trying to get this money." And the next thing we know, we've got Bundy Ranch, and China is making some major investments in Nevada, you know, good for Nevada, but it's been bought at a price. That's factually true. That is a factually accurate statement that I've just made. The highest priority of government should have been to get this money back. The $2.3 trillion has now grown because it's been in a bank account in Hong Kong since 1999, and it is now equal to $13.6 trillion U.S. dollars. And another 1 trillion euros, which is equal to 1.3 trillion U.S. dollars, that brings it was paid as bribes and kickbacks to the banksters who are hiding it and holding it. So, if the United States was in a position of strength, power, you know, if Obama had cojones, really, if Obama had cojones, we could go in and we could say, "Look, buddy, that's our money. We want it back. Hand it over." And if we had the power that we used to have 10 years ago when I was dealing with Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi, we could do it on moral ground. I mean, it's our money, for God's sakes.
Wouldn't work.
It is our money.
Those are the earnings
from our money.
But, you know, China now is a world power with ambitions.
Yes.
So they're not going to take a step back like that, are they?
No. And that's the change the United States is facing. And it is a humbling change. It is a frightening change, because they are doing to us exactly what we have done to others. You know, when I was interested in doing this interview for that reason, because I realize you're European nationalists, but I think that it's interesting to consider the changing power
we're an American
paradigm
website.
Of the United States in relationship of the world.
Hmm.
And the power that is now being attributed to Africa and to Latin America and the emerging economies, and they're trying to, like you said, what they're doing is they're trying to morph the emerging economies and those peoples into our societies, so that they can share the wealth a little bit more.
And but it isn't and wealth. In fact, the emerging economies, with the possible exception of China. But certainly India, Brazil very much so. These are economies that are built on debt, yet again. It is yet another story, just like warfare is another story of real power coming into the hands of a very few people.
Well, you know, I would just like to say I think the United States is going to become more dangerous and more unstable because you asked if they're sociopaths.
I think
they're psychopathic.
In their death throes, they're going to be even more dangerous. So.
Yes.
Just as a matter of interest, I mean, you were talking about the welfare issue that binds Latinos to the current American system. There's also a very powerful emotional desire amongst Latinos to establish their own homeland. I mean, one only has to look on the internet for 2 seconds about that, and you soon come across, you know, Aztlan, and there's a lot of talk about it at the very lowest levels of society. People are aware of this. So, and then there's this idea, of course, that you know, we'll take it through the wombs of our women. But welfare dependency would counter against that, wouldn't it? It would be something that actually holds America together regardless. So you're talking about a force of perpetual impoverishment.
They will never have a homeland in Texas.
Never.
That would be a war. If they ever tried to take California or Texas or Arizona or New Mexico, there would be a war over that.
I think their idea would be to
really
do it through numbers.
They are, however, deeply determined to get as much welfare. It's just a society, a culture of welfare dependency at all levels, and just, you know, passive aggressive welfare dependency. Like, you're going to have to feed me because I'm not going to feed myself, so what am I going to do? And the idea that they would take responsibility for themselves, and if you don't if you can't get work because you're not educated, here's the problem, here's the cycle. You refuse to become literate. You refuse to learn how to read. You refuse to teach your children how to read. And therefore, you're not capable of holding these advanced jobs. Then this stubborn poverty. Well, I talk to people who've been in the country 15 years. Well, I don't know how to read. You can't make me. Well, why? You know, I shouldn't have to make you. If you want to come into my country, then you should rise. You need to grow up. You need to raise your ideals higher. And it's what we're seeing in the Middle East is the same problem. The Arab community, they want to have their Islamic Sharia rights protected here in the United States, and and then we have to give up our privacy rights. We have to submit to ever more intrusive surveillance. I had a very strange experience because, as part of my attack, and I don't usually talk about this, but as part of my attack, the Iraqi exiles in the Detroit area, that they got in really tight with the Bush administration, and they want to go back and be triumphant at home, and they want to enact revenge against the people who are in their homeland. And so, because I had been inside the Iraqi embassy, and because I had loudly opposed sanctions, and I loudly opposed the war, the Iraqi exiles themselves wanted to get me. Now, here are people who've come into my country, and they do not share our tradition of freedom and freedom of speech and the right to criticize and dissent from the government.
Is this here, Ahmed Chalabi?
Ahmed Chalabi and his friends, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Hmm.
Yes.
Well,
and so they
excited.
Think that they, you know, and again, is America acting in its own best interests if we destroy our freedom to protect their minority rights?
Right.
And this is not something that people like to admit. But America is in the throes of a huge fight over immigration right now. And there's a great fear, especially from I know we keep coming back to the Latinos, but that's where it's a lot of it is originating here from, is just that anyway, so I tend to view it in terms of the bigger issue of the drugs, which I am convinced we're going to see a big push now to legalize drugs throughout the United States, because it's an effort, it's a methodology for keeping the poor people out of politics and keeping them physically incapacitated.
Well,
we don't have
we're
jobs
all out
for them.
Of politics. I don't think that there's any, you know, ever going to be a return to a true politics. It's been achieved simply by, as you said earlier, by the parties essentially declaring out of court all the great questions of the age, and leading us to argue over these petty issues, managerial issues of the state.
Yes.
You know, that are important in their own right, but they're not about the future of our people as a whole, and that has been taken away from us. And it's the same everywhere throughout the West. You know, why has this happened? What is the ultimate objective of the people who've engineered this? Because it's not a force of nature. It's not.
Yes.
It's not something that's inevitable. It's just, you know, in the genes. It's not an accident. It's not bad luck.
Right.
It's an engineered process, and it's happening on an enormous scale. And when, as soon, of course, as anybody like us, mere laymen, you know, start to talk about it, we get shut down on the basis of, well, it's conspiracy theory or tinfoil hat, and all this sort of thing. So we're left seeing the event. We know that there are discussions amongst very, very powerful forces that are held in private. We know about that. We've got some pretty useless characters, Alex Jones type characters, you know, David Icke type characters, who are misdirecting like crazy on all of this. And it's very difficult to get an intelligent view of the whole process. But basically, its name is globalization. And,
yes.
You know, one has the feeling that somebody has written a script, and that script has two names. The outer name, the name that is discussed in academia, is the globality, the creation of a global economy, essentially for very narrow interests. And the inner name is Olam Haba, the age of Moshach, because the most powerful of these interests are Jews. And so
yes.
We come into another completely forbidden subject that we're not allowed to push through and discuss, because we are moral reprobates for doing so. So that's where we stop. We can't get any further than that.
Isn't native nationalism one of the answers to that?
Well, here in the United States, I'm going to say the Israel word. We have so much dual citizenship in government that it is considered treasonous for the United States to oppose Israel. If you for those in the CIA particularly are flogged if they do not support a pro-Israeli viewpoint of American foreign policy that gives Israel the total rights and advantages. And I found that myself. I, however, do have a different, like always, I have to be contrarian. I have always believed that American foreign policy needs to put America first, and it needs to push Israel off into the distance, because they have a very different foreign policy agenda, which is to use up the last of our American century, which is dying fast. We haven't even made it a whole 100 years yet, and we're in the last decade probably, if we even have another decade, and they're using up whatever we have left to recreate the Middle East to their advantage, they think. Now, I will tell you that for every action, there is a reaction, and ISIL, God help us all, is a reaction to these horrible wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and all of the brutality, all of the torture, all, you know, if we want to blame anyone for this, I have to tell you, we have to blame ourselves. They have been brutalized, they have been emasculated, and they're fighting back.
It's like
that does not make it a good thing. That does not. I am not saying that
ISIL. We have to blame our sellouts. We have to blame our elite sellouts. Those who are going along with Israel and Jewish interests for the money.
Yes.
We also have to be sympathetic for rank and file Americans. They're beholden to this. It's not.
Well, you know, the problem is we always have money for Lockheed Martin, but we never have money for our soldiers. We don't pay them pensions. We don't give them disability benefits that they could actually live on. And that offends me. You know, these soldiers, they join the military. They're young men who want to serve our country, who want to protect, and there's some very good people in the military. Mm. Come on. And we don't have money to pay them, but we can give Lockheed Martin bonuses and 100, you know, six-figure salaries. We're supporting the Halliburton elite only. And I, like I said, this is the only thing we're manufacturing.
I've been sympathetic to these guys since the Vietnam draft. I've been fighting these wars which have nothing to do with a clear and present danger to America. It's all wrong.
Yes. These are the hardest issues that we're facing, and I think they really are. You're dealing with issues that are more, you know, for mature audiences only. Because it's not about racism. It's easy to label it as a racist discussion. It's not. It is a question of distribution of wealth and assets and taking and
that's right. It's accountability.
We're already so loaded with problems. Why are we creating more interface with people who have already jumped off the edge of the cliff? Why are we trying to resurrect them at all? We do need to take care of ourselves first.
They wouldn't be a part of our interests if we wanted them to be. You know,
yes,
they would not identify with us even if we begged them to.
Yeah, they don't want to. And we face this all the time in the United States. Everybody wants to come to America. You know,
they still do.
They still do. Yeah. No, and I, you know,
you better wait, because if this thing if this thing cracks open, it's going to happen first in Europe. It's going to happen first in Europe. There's a little.
There's a video on
YouTube. It was obviously made by some Serbians or Bosnians or something. It's got that feel of, you know, it's been made by somebody who basically talked like this, you know, and he can't spell. Obviously, in the original, there's a voiceover, but for our benefit, there's this no voiceover, but these words come up, and they are not that grammatical. However, having said that, it uses a lot of, very bravely, because it's all under copyright that belongs to somebody else, it uses a lot of images from films that have been made, from news reels that have been raided, and comes up for the first couple of minutes with these extraordinarily troubling images of a Europe in terrible crisis, and it explains how this comes about, mostly through Islam's bloody borders, but also through the ineffable capacity of Africans to act in their own interests with violence. And you know, the bottom line is that Europe is destroyed. This is called Europe 2029.
Yes.
But it doesn't quite finish up with more than a question. Well, maybe you think this won't happen, but, you know, we think it's coming, sort of thing. Well, I think it's coming too. I don't think that America will suffer that.
I think it is coming too.
I think France
might.
I
think it is coming. I think you're definitely going to get hit.
So with this coming breakup and these catastrophes, how do we talk to these people? How do we talk to the people who still have a vestige of power?
I don't think you can.
No,
I don't think you're listening. I don't think they're listening at all. The example that I gave you of me going to Harry Reid with the documentation and the bank account information, as much financial documentation, and giving it to the FBI, giving it to the Secret Service, giving it to Nancy Pelosi and saying, here it is, go get it. You know, we need some leadership here. And I'm like, did you and I not read the same memo? Do you not realize who these people are? And they definitely know who they are. They are very well informed as to what's going on. But they've made a choice. The choice is to pursue their own self-interest, their own self-preservation. And the choice is not to support the American people.
Is there any sympathy in the CIA to these nativist interests?
Yes, I think there is, but they would see it as a U.S.-Israeli joint combined interest. That's the fatal flaw.
Definitely.
I think that that's the fatal flaw.
Yeah. So we're not talking to them, we're talking amongst ourselves, and we have to make it clear that we're not interested in war and killing people and exploiting people and lording ourselves over the people. We want our sovereignty as identifiable peoples and to maintain our ancient human ecologies.
Oh, I think that you'll find that in the United States there's a huge pushback against immigration for exactly that reason. For exactly the reasons you're talking about. There is a fear.
It's under the radar.
There's so many problems. No, I think that in the next 6 months it's going to explode right out on the scene. Wow. Just like it is in Europe right now, which has been absorbing so much of the Arab peoples and the African peoples. The problem is they are not rising. And it's pulling the weight of society is it's like an anchor.
On the other hand, if they did integrate, this would be the end of our...
Yes. Well, then they should go back where they
came.
This
would be the end of us.
Africa should be African.
Sure.
And we should be European, or you should be European, and we should be American. And,
you're European.
You know, why do we have to take in the world's... two things that we have to ask ourselves. Why does America have to be the world's police? And why does America have to be the world's savior?
Why do we have to absorb these
it's
populations?
In the interests
why do we
of
have to save you?
It?
Not you, but I mean like the African people, the Mexican people. We can't. We cannot save everybody. And Europe is in the same situation.
But I don't think it's that kind of event. I mean, I think you have to look at this as simply being a necessary step to a global society, which essentially consists of the very, very wealthy, the ultra wealthy. And the rest of mankind, which is there to work and consume.
Yes. Stop.
And, you know, we're not meant to have nativist sympathies. We're not meant to be peoples. We're not meant to express love for kind or understanding for kind or to have any barriers or distinctions between us. We are merely the lumpen mass of humanity. That is what this is really trying to engineer. And Europe is first in line.
That's how you maintain accountability in human ecology. This is 41,000 years as Europeans.
Yes.
That's being toyed with.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's being degraded and lost.
Yes.
I see more conflict coming because these people, they. This is I think Europe is going to see this more than the United States, that this will be a source of major conflict, that they want to come into our societies, but like I said about the Mexicans, they don't want to learn to read. They want us to adopt to them. They want us to raise them and elevate them and promote them and just get them graduate, get them GEDs, get them high school diplomas, but
Susan,
don't really bother
there
them.
There are three elements. Before we close up, there are three elements to this that you have to remember. There are three elements in play. There is the great sort of victim native peoples who are suffering this ingress and who are being changed forever. And then there are the peoples that are coming in who are being used to effect that change, and we're expected to engage in a conflict with each other, and then to one side is the organizing elites who are seeking the opportunity to impose a security solution, and that is the end game, and that's what this is really all about.
Yes.
The creation of a global security driven economic unit. And if we don't want that, then sooner or later we have to turn in on ourselves, and we have to look at ourselves and say, well, you know, I have my own interests, I have my own connectedness, I have my own history and heritage, and that I value above all other things.
My own economy.
My own economy, and that I will seek to protect, even at the cost of my life. I will fight for that.
Problem
That's
is
what it comes down to.
But it's going to erupt into violence because there is the problem is that the racial issue is this is the thing. No one wants to say the word that it's because they want to pretend that racism is over, but or that race is not a factor.
Yeah, but these things are generated.
But these are not educated people who could contribute ever. And so what happens is that it becomes the haves and the have-nots, and it's going to aggravate all of these tensions, all of these social tensions, when they're not capable of joining our society at a high enough level to participate and contribute. When they're dragging us down, they will eventually turn on us and attack us, just like they're doing to you. And they're going to do it in Europe a lot harder and faster, I think. I think that Europe is going to be in because they have no future. They don't have a future in Europe.
And Europeans have more grounds to fight. It's they have more historical basis.
They have their own future as themselves under multiculturalism. I mean, integrationism has been tried in France and failed, but under the multicultural system, the only group which is afforded no protection from government is the native group. Everybody else has their own cultural roots that they can transfer and are encouraged to put down so they don't lose their identities. And this is the nature of multiculturalism. It's the same in America as here. And ultimately, its fruit is division. And therefore, you know, you have to say, well, the people who've been generating this, they're intelligent. It must be the division that they really want.
So if we're going to prosecute a meaningful individual, what sorts of people and entities do we begin to look at?
Well, the first thing you need is people like Susan who come out of the establishment and name names and reveal. You know, you need Edward Snowden's and people of this kind who, you know, Bradley Cooper, who will actually provide hard data. Yeah? Into the public domain.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true.
Because we don't have that. We're kept in this sort of cloud of ignorance. All these decisions are taken from somewhere above, and they are, because in every European government, the same policies are followed. There is no difference between one party in one country and another party in you know, nothing changes. It's all proceeding in the same general direction, and you have to say, therefore, that this is a globally engineered phenomenon. And to break that down, in a democracy, it's still possible to oppose it, but not without undeniable, hard, evidentially based dissent. That's the way that this thing can be brought to the attention of the people, because otherwise, without that, what we end up with is these very ill-informed nationalist parties that are struggling to make progress and are easily sidelined.
Like Nigel Farage, UKIP.
Well, he might get somewhere. He might not.
He looks a lot like Ron Paul. Just a.
I think there's the possibility.
A safety valve.
Yeah. Some while ago, I wrote a piece. You might remember it, about the four possible fates of UKIP. There's four possible ways that they could go, and three of them are negative from the point of view of actually doing something historically useful. One of them, the outside chance, is that it might lead to a severe problem for the establishment, the loss of their ideology, and the beginning of a movement towards a more healthy democracy. But we shall see. I mean, you know, we're nobody. We just debate these things and try to kick them around in the hope that Well, I do think that, you know, but I mean, we do what we can at our own level in the hope that somebody somewhere will learn some lessons, or if they've got some answers that they might come that we haven't got, they might come and provide them, and that in the round knowledge becomes more broadly available and deeper, and that's what it's all about. And Susan, I think, you know, at that point we better call it a day. I want to thank you very, very much. Really unusual conversation, and I think you're a great girl. And if ever you come to London, kid, you know, I'll buy you a meal.
I would love to come to London, but I tell you, MI6 would probably like to kill me.
Yeah, well, don't worry about them. I'll have a word.
That's a good sign.
Make sure I'm safe. I was once told by an Egyptian diplomat that I didn't have to worry about my safety, because if I arrived in Cairo, he'd make sure he had the entire military out to escort me through the city.
Well, according to the latest news, they're going to reduce the army in this country to 60,000 in order that, you know, our terrible debts, because that's how everybody gets control through debt, can be met. debts are something for this little country are currently running at 1.4 trillion of sterling, which is, you know, perhaps in the American context, it's not a great deal, but there's only 60 million of us.
Yes.
We're looking at a very weak army in the future. If you're going to come and the army's going to come out and protect you, you better make it quick. But thank you very, very much, Susan. Been a delight to talk to you. And
thank you.
Perhaps we'll be able to
much.
Talk again sometime.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Bye for now. Bye-bye.